Hi everybody, Andy here. Just before we start this week's episode, wanted to introduce you to our special guest. This week's guest is the brilliant Stevie Martin. If you haven't heard of Stevie, you are in for a treat. She is a fantastic comedian. Everything she makes is good. She makes wonderful sketches, she's in shows, she's on stuff. And if you want to hear more of her after this episode, which you will, check out her podcast, which is called Nobody Panic. It's a great show. It contains advice about absolutely everything in the world, how to do your taxes, how to brush your hair, some even funnier things than that, can you believe it? It's a great show. I think I did an episode recently which is coming up for release, but just start listening to that now. Once again, it's called Nobody Panic. Hope you enjoy this show. On with the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, a weekly podcast coming to you from the QI offices in Holborn. My name is Dan Schreiber. I'm sitting here with Andrew Hunter-Murray, Anna Tyshinsky, and Stevie Martin. And once again, we have gathered around the microphones with our four favorite facts from the last 7 days. And in no particular order, here we go. Starting with fact number one, and that is Stevie.
My fact is that Australia is wider than the moon. Except... technically, it's not.
What?
Oh, wow.
No, you can't row back on the fact. I did some verification. I think you're absolutely right.
I've got to back myself more, says my mum. So it is. If I was looking at it, it would be. But if I was, like, taking into account surface area, perhaps, and the fact that it's a sphere...
That's right.
That's not what you said.
Yeah, man.
I said wider.
Wider.
Yeah, if we moved Australia, so it's in the place of the moon, it would be.
It would look
cover
like
it from left to right and then some.
Yeah.
Like an eclipse. Like it could. You could move the moon and it would block the sun, possibly. Would it? Is it tall enough?
Australia?
Yeah. It may not be tall enough. I don't know. Is Australia quite flat? Is it a flat boy from the top to the bottom?
It's why I think that you would get bits of moon poking out. I don't think there's any Australia arrangement that totally covers the moon, but it is definitely wider left to right. There's no doubt.
But you might be able to cut bits off or move Tasmania, for instance, to one of the poking out bits.
To accommodate it.
They'd love that. They'd love that.
Politically controversial plan already. Like, feels like they've probably had to put up with a lot. I don't know. I don't know anything about it. So the moon is about 3,500 kilometres across, and Australia is about, when we look at it in the sky, and Australia is about 4,000.
Yeah, it's about 4,000. Yeah.
Did you know that the smallest moon of Jupiter, which is so small, it's called called Jupiter LII. It doesn't have a name. Is the same size as Vatican City.
Is it?
Yeah.
It's almost not worth it.
It's not worth it.
Do we know it's a moon? Does anyone know what the smallest amount has to be for it to be a moon?
Oh, there are all sorts of
Is it the
technical...
Vatican City? Is that it?
That's it. Yeah. If it can have a pope, it's a moon.
It's a moon.
That's it.
It's hugely contentious. That question's hugely contentious in that world.
Okay.
Yeah. We'll get emails, just dozens, hundreds of emails now that you've asked.
Wait, doesn't the moon have a bishop? I'm sure we've vaguely said this in the past, that there is a guy whose role is bishop of the moon.
Oh, yes, yeah. When they tried to claim it as theirs, and it got given its own bishop. I mean, I think self-proclaimed.
Is that like when I was 14, my mum bought me a little plot of land on the moon? And you get a little deed. So I've got a deed.
Oh, no.
You did that.
So if there's any mineral rights in, like, maybe a centimetre square somewhere on the moon.
You'll get none of it.
None of it because it's not legally binding. Because I'm sure she bought it in, like, a paper chase. But if... the bishop thing, I think, checks out. Imagine if there was a bishop in my bit.
That's incredible.
Well, that's why the Popemobile has that dome over the top, the bubble.
Because people own it.
It's so that he can... If he needs to, he can operate in a lunar environment.
Yes.
Small square of the Pope as well. That's why I got my 15th birthday.
Wouldn't it be crazy for the UN or whoever it is to say, right, we are going to divide up the moon, but we've decided that paper chase are the people who are going to administer this system.
You do need people to do admin.
You do.
They might have put in the best bid.
You're absolutely right.
I don't think that's too far a crazy idea. They've got the paper to make the certificates. I think it's a really...
It was high GSM.
Here's an interesting thing. So the space between the moon... and the Earth, right?
Yeah.
So that is roughly, because it changes all the time, but at, like, its furthest, it's big enough that you could take all of our planets in the solar system and you could put them next to each other in one big row and they would all fit between the space between the Earth and the moon.
No.
Yeah, that is good.
Isn't that extraordinary?
Even Jupiter?
But Jupiter's so big.
No, excluding Jupiter.
Sorry, I forgot to mention, not Jupiter.
I always think we don't make a massive enough deal about the coincidence of the moon and the sun and the fact that we can have a full eclipse, right? Because the only reason we can have a full solar eclipse is the fact that the moon and the sun look exactly the same size to us on Earth. And that's just a total coincidence. It's just proportionally the size of the moon and the distance of the moon from us makes it the same size to us.
And then in a million years, when because the moon's moving away like a few centimetres a year, we won't have full eclipses anymore because it'll be too far away to cover the entirety of the sun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the chances were just infinitesimally tiny, and I think that is evidence for a higher power, if ever there was it, the fact that they're basically the same size to us.
I like the idea that in the future, when the moon is smaller and it goes across, it'll make the sun look like a bagel.
A really stingy bagel though. Imagine getting a bagel that thin with a huge hole.
Yeah, I like that though.
Can I tell you about the first Australian person to go to space?
Ooh, yeah.
Paul Desmond Scully Power.
Cool. Cool.
He's the first ever astronaut, I'm calling him.
Nice.
I did try and find online if anyone's used that. I don't think anyone says astronaut.
Maybe because it's
happened to one guy.
Also, it could be like Austrian as well, so it's kind of confusing.
Oh yeah, that'll lead to heaps of confusion.
Yeah,
I
was confused.
Dozens and dozens
it.
Of yeah. But he was also the first astronaut with a beard.
Wow.
Yeah.
In the gravity, his beard would be floating all over the place like he was a wizard.
Exactly.
Wait, was it like my beard, or are we talking Gandalf?
It's in between. He didn't have a Gandalf beard, very sadly. I think even NASA did try and make him shave, and he said, no, it's fine. And so they tried to make a shave. They said it won't form an airtight seal, and presumably you'll asphyxiate. And he said, I think it'll be all right.
It's worth the risk.
She'll be right. He is so Aussie. It's brilliant. Like he said, going to space was just one of those things that happened, because he started off as an oceanographer, and then because he liked surfing and was studying maths, and then he got into the Aussie Navy, and then he exchanged over to the US Navy, and they said, we need someone to do a naval study, an ocean study rather, from space. So mm-hmm. Do you want to, you know, get on board? And he did. He's founded a drone company called the Ripper Group. He's created shark finding AI.
Oh my god.
He's just like
it's in his contract, conforming to stereotype.
Really,
we'll only let you up there if
I know. As the shuttle was about to take off, you know, you're sitting like, I guess you're facing the sky, so you're sort of lying on your back within a chair, right?
What did he do?
He fell asleep.
Oh, okay.
I thought you were saying he like barbecue or something.
Exactly.
he stood in a surf position as it went up.
That's amazing. And his beard will have been sort of parted as they went.
Oh. All you could see is the rocket left the atmosphere. Two strands of beard.
Anyway, what a guy.
What a guy.
What's his name? What's he called?
He's called Paul Desmond Scully Power.
What a great name.
Yeah. Really
Paul strong. Power.
Paul Power.
That's brilliant.
There's just, speaking of the moon and Australia,
I
found a really cool thing online, and it's an interactive page, and it's this website that's created by the people who wrote a book called Cosmos, the Infographic Book of Space, which I think has loads of really cool infographics about space in it, as you'd expect.
Whoa!
It's a shame they couldn't nail that onto the cover somehow.
They needed me writing their subtitle.
Your Amazon reviews of books are so shit, aren't they? They're so bad.
Anyway, they've also got a website, and they have this whole interactive section, and one of the interactive sections, which I strongly recommend that you Google, is you can see how high a human or a kangaroo could jump on various celestial bodies. So they'll drop down, you can select human or kangaroo, no other things, because they're the two main ones that would go into space. And then, yeah, you can see how high they jump. So on the moon, we could jump 3 meters, pretty good.
Yeah.
Kangaroo, 11 meters. Better. It's always better, the kangaroo.
I was going to say, yeah. It's relative, isn't it?
Yeah. It's really fun, quite a lot. It really tricks you, and I wasted a lot of time because it has things like some of the tiniest moons in the solar system, and it'll do see how high you could jump on this, and you click jump, and then you sit there as it goes up and up, and it doesn't really tell you if it's going to go on forever or if it's going to stop at some point. So I did sit there for about 8 minutes watching it go up and up, thinking, I wonder if I'm coming back down. And sometimes you don't.
Really?
Gosh, that's bleak, isn't it?
It's a bit sad. Don't jump.
Don't jump.
Like asteroids and stuff.
You know how the moon looks too big? It looks bigger than it is when we look at it.
Too big.
Yeah. When you look at the moon in the night sky, you think, oh, what a beautiful moon. Then you take a photo and there's a dot.
Yes.
Oh.
I did that this morning.
Right.
Yes.
And it's really weird. It's a weird effect.
Yeah, why is that though?
Well, we sort of prioritize it more with our eyes.
Oh, okay.
But there are various reasons why. Sometimes the moon looks very big if it's near the horizon because it's closer to things that we recognize, like, you know, houses or trees or whatever. You know, you sort of see it in reference to those and you think it's bigger than it is.
Mm. But wait, are you saying that it takes you so long to grapple to get your camera that by the time you've taken the photo, it's actually moved up into the sky?
No, because even when you look at it in the night sky, it looks bigger to our eyes than it does on a camera. You know, and cameras are telling the truth. But there is a way of negating the effect of the moon, this effect of it looking too big, which is look at it upside down.
Oh.
Yeah.
How do I turn the moon upside down?
I do a headstand.
You go to Australia.
You go to Australia. You put your head between your legs.
Okay.
As you're standing there, and it looks the right size again.
Really?
Yeah, this was studied by two Japanese scientists. They won an Ig Nobel Prize for their paper.
For telling people to put their head between the legs and look at the moon.
Perceived size and perceived distance of targets viewed from between the legs.
I almost want to disagree with them, but it's a fact.
You haven't tried it. But next time you're out on a romantic nighttime stroll and the person you're with says, look at the lovely moon, you can say to them, no, look at it between your legs and we'll see it.
But that works, you know, like sometimes, I think it was the last year, you could see Jupiter really well next to the moon. And I looked at some planes, but then I also did see Jupiter. So if I looked between my legs, it would look like Jupiter.
Yes.
It brings it closer to you.
Oh, wait, no, to make it smaller.
No, it looks smaller.
It looks smaller between your legs.
So I want to do the opposite. Okay, fine, right. Yeah. I could get my legs through my head in order to bring it. Right, okay, cool, thank you.
Check this out. I don't fully understand the science of this, but I find it amazing because it's true. And that is that on a rainy day, if the moon is overhead, it's going to rain less.
I know.
Yeah.
Hmm? That frightens me on a very deep level.
On a
level.
Rainy day, if the moon is overhead, it's going to rain less.
Why? So if the moon, rather than, like, sometimes you see the moon, which is, like, closer to horizontal.
On the horizon.
But, yeah, exactly. And then you get high in the sky, right? The moon's
different
spots. Yeah, orbit.
When it's there, let's say it's a cloudy day and it's raining, it's going to rain less.
But it's already...
Is it the gravitational pull?
Is it sucking the rain towards
the rain
it?
Up.
Yeah.
So the rain goes up in the air towards the moon.
Space rain is what happens.
Upside down space rain. Okay. Well, so it just doesn't. It stays within the atmosphere.
Yeah, exactly. The clouds. So the gravitational pull with the moon, it's all to do with the kind of pressure that it's creating around in the air as well. So the pressure can suck up the moisture that's in there. So it's just kind of it's not weighted so that it falls down. But so it will still rain. But by less.
It does make sense. It would be freaking bizarre if it just didn't rain in a Truman Show way.
Yeah,
just
over
that spot where the moon was.
But it's less by 1%.
That's a lot.
Oh, it's not a lot. Contrary, it's not a lot.
That's
a really relevant
thing. It's a lot of rain.
I was about to leave my umbrella at home before Dan said it's 1%. Now I think I'll take it anyway.
Yeah, but you can drill a hole in your umbrella that's 1% the size of it. And then as long as that's in the right position, then it won't matter.
You're fine.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's a thought.
But they did this.
Science.
They studied it for ages, 1998 to 2012. They were looking at reports. And then they looked at meteorological reports that go all the way back to the 1800s. And they found that on the days where the moon was in those positions.
1% less rainy.
1% less rainy.
Nice. I just love that fact so much.
Yeah. Australia's got its first ever moon rover. It was getting its first ever moon rover.
Okay.
This is quite cool.
Yeah.
It's going to go
why?
Up.
Why? Why are they doing that?
It's just being included on a future mission. I think, Australia has a space program. Ask Paul Power. And it's going to be included. But I'd just like to see, can you guess the name? There were 8,000 suggestions of a name and one winner. And it's gettable.
And it's an Aussie...
100%. Is it Mooney McMoonface?
It's not Mooney McMoonface. Okay. It is something actually Australian.
God.
And you're going to kick yourselves right up the
big
arse if you don't
get it. Big old moon spider.
That's good.
So it's a rover. It's a car. Right. It's a...
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Good. A rune rover.
You're so close.
Oh, really?
This is agony.
Kangarover.
What'd you say?
Kangarover.
I'm going to give it to you. Ruver is what its name is.
What? I was way closer.
What did you say?
Rune Rover.
Rune Rover?
Yeah.
Absolutely not, Dan. That was a shocking get. That called me.
Wait, say it again. What is it?
Ruver.
Come on. You should put Kanga in front.
She said Kangarover. It was closer than Rune Rover. I had to sit here not saying anything, just being like, mm hmm. Yeah. Oh. Anyway, it's going to be called Rover. And it will weigh about the same as a Western grey kangaroo.
Cool.
Or four wallabies.
Was that deliberate?
That's deliberate, yeah. That's integral to the design.
Four wallabies, buy wallabies. Okay, it is time for fact number two, and that's my fact. My fact this week is that as a child, Roald Dahl was used as a guinea pig for a chocolate factory.
Cool. That's very on the nose.
Yeah.
It makes me wonder about all the other books as well. Like, did he have a big peach one day?
Yes. Was he a twit?
So he went to the school called Repton, and at Repton there was a local Cadbury's. It was either a factory or it was just a base where they were sending chocolate out for it to be tested around the country. Either way, what they used to do was they used to ask for kids from the school to apply to be guinea pigs in order to test out these chocolates and see whether they were fit for the market, and Dahl happened to be there at the time. So he would have been like 13, 14 years old at the time. Yeah, he spent 4 years at this place, and it had a huge impact on him. He did think off the back of it, what's going inside these chocolate factories? I bet it's a marvelous, incredible place. And it was the seed for what then became Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Wow. The pod.
Was there a lot of injuries while he was there?
My chocolate had a finger in it this week. Horrible. Wow.
We know if any of the kids in that classroom, when the teacher said, have we got any volunteers to test out chocolate in a chocolate factory, was there a single child who didn't put their hand up?
Yeah,
it's like a dream for a child.
It's just, oh my God.
It's a dream gig.
Professional chocolate testers are a thing, but not many of them. And it's not as good a gig as maybe Dahl made it sound.
You get quite sick, though, wouldn't you? Sick.
You also develop an incredibly advanced palate.
Oh, so then nothing satisfies
you. You're ruined. But basically, you get chocolate that's a few hours old. You know, it's ultra fresh and you know it's delicious. And you're always thinking whenever you eat anything else, you know, you're ruined for Yorkies. Basically, you can't it just tastes like trash to you. But one thing they do is that real chocolate experts and tasters, they listen to the chocolate.
Okay.
What's it saying?
What's going on there? Is that like a phrase, like wine has a nose or whatever? Is it like
literally is?
They listen to it.
They listen to the snap sound it makes when you break a piece of the chocolate. They'll give it a listen to make sure.
Is there a thing like with cheese where once I went to a party and someone was like, "Oh, we fridged the brie for too long," and they were like panicking? Did you like fridge chocolate or not fridge? You know, because if you put it in the fridge and then you snap it, it goes.
Lovely snap.
Would they hate that? Probably.
I'm sure they would hate all sorts of things. Like, I'm sure that refrigerating chocolate is probably a deep no-no or
it
something.
It probably is.
You'd be sacked immediately if you knew anyone who'd ever done it. Probably.
Yeah, it's true.
But they do. And actually, someone I know went on a chocolate, got a chocolate expert in for the day. And,
great.
As a team building exercise, I think they did a chocolate tasting.
Oh, okay.
Just to their house.
Yeah. Okay.
And the chocolate expertier who came around.
I'm the chocolate expertier.
This is going great.
Got them all, all these quite serious business people who work in finance, and they're all sitting there listening to their chocolate.
Oh really? Yeah. Like a tuning fork.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, they do. Jobs don't come up much sort of publicly for chocolate factories, but occasionally Cadbury will sort of say, we're looking for new taste testers. And they did that at one point where they put a sort of open audition out, and there's so many, 4,000 applicants, everyone went. And they made the point of saying, this isn't going to be easy. This isn't just you sitting and eating chocolate saying, wow, how yummy. Like, it's really intense. They had to go spend 2.5 hours a day having their taste buds put to different chocolate tasting tests. They had to sit in a soundproof booth. They had red lasers going around so that
they
could see the type.
Why are they in a soundproof booth?
To hear the chocolate.
I guess it's a sensory booth rather than soundproof, but it's a similar thing.
Sorry, when you said that they said, it's not just about eating loads of chocolate all day, but the first thing you said was they had to sit and have their taste subjected to loads of chocolate for ages. I mean, that's just eating loads of chocolate.
Intensely. But
though.
It's intensely.
Yeah. I think they're slightly trying to SAS what is quite a nice job. You obviously have to write down quite a lot of detail, I guess, about what you're tasting.
Well, because they don't like work. They don't like if you say like caramelly, They're like, no, we want the components. We want the makeup of this. We don't
want
you to say
it. They should know what's in it already. Like, I shouldn't be required to retro-engineer their chocolates for them.
No,
I should be saying if I like it or not.
No, because you want to be able to say, oh, that hint of nutmeg is really speaking to me. You know, you want to... You want
to get
the extra bits.
I see what you mean. Yeah, you don't want
to just go, well, that's caramelly.
That's my one. Was shaped like a tiny seahorse, and I love that.
A Gion. Oh. I once did for Aussie shampoo. I went in and tested their new scent.
Oh.
And I just remember smelling one and being like, immediately, they were like, so what are the components, can you smell? And all I could think of was like, it smells like a man one. It smells like a musky, like a musk man one. And they were like, yes, because of why? And it was like, because it's like other men shampoo. And then I didn't really say anything for the rest of the hour because I was like, I actually can't smell. That's what I discovered. Unless it's like, yeah, a man one.
So wow. Like they pay, do they pay you in advance for that job?
They did pay me in advance for that job, yes, thank God. Otherwise it would have, yeah.
Well, I think it is nice enough that employees at the Cadbury's factory, and this was a stat from about 10 years ago, so it may not be true now, but they can still eat as much of the product as they like, and they do tend to put on half a stone in the first 10 days of their employment.
10 days?
Yeah, wow. And then I imagine you pare back. I don't think you keep on gaining half a stone for every 10 days.
I would have thought they'd have a bucket. You know, you spit your chocolate into the bucket.
Oh, like tobacco, like a cowboy.
Probably a bit joyless.
Yeah.
Maybe they do, but then you can eat whatever you like from that bucket at the end of the day.
Like a fondue.
Yeah.
Yes.
God. I assume they all just have no teeth, right?
Yeah.
You have the new guys coming in, and they're like, well, we want to be careful about the first 10 days.
You do put on weight, but you save weight because your teeth weigh quite a lot.
Sounds like a great job.
So, hey, Cadbury, that was the biggie. That was the thing that started chocolate off, basically, in terms of this big global Willy Wonka-esque kind of world. Yeah. Well, for me, that's Cadbury's always been the global brand. And so it was started by a guy called John Cadbury. I was looking into him. He was born in Birmingham. He's the son of Richard Cadbury and his wife, Elizabeth Head. Very sad that they didn't take on the double barrel surname, because you would have had Dickhead Cadbury. That would have been a lovely name. And then, check this out, his second wife. Actually, his middle name was Tapper, so that's good anyway. Tapper.
Would you like a nice fruit and nut Dick Tapper? Yeah.
Great.
What's his wife called? Bellen.
So his second wife was called Candia. He married a Candy.
Wow.
No.
Yeah. Wow. But yeah, so he was an amazing guy, John Cadbury. He was very into animal rights. He set up the Animals Friends Society, which basically is what led into the RSPCA eventually coming about. It was sort of the forerunner and sort of molded into that. And then he passed his company on to his sons. And they've set up this incredible place because they were Quakers. And so they've got this little place called Bourneville, which was given its name because it sounded French and therefore would sound really kind of upper class. Yeah. So they just gave it...
Yeah, Dickhead Town didn't fly for some reason. Welcome, I'm the mayor of Dickhead Town.
And it's
like a model village.
It's a model village, and it's still going to this day.
I find the terminology model village quite confusing because it means two quite different things.
You're right.
He didn't set up a village of tiny houses that
that's
you can
what
walk around.
That's what I thought it was. I was like, wow, what a great hobby
for all the Oompa Loompas.
Yeah. So he set up just what, like a nice small village? What's a model village?
It was for the work. It was for Cadbury's workers, and it was basically. It was a village of houses that were built along new architectural lines. They were designed to be, a development from the horrible slums that you got in urban centres.
Right.
Every house had a garden and every house had a fruit tree and things like this. And, people were encouraged to live basically clean, healthy lives. These were all quite teetotal places as well.
That's the thing.
That's the downside.
It's boring.
Right. Unless it's changed recently, and there's been quite a few people that have been trying to buckle it. It's a dry town, which is nuts.
It's because the Quakers were... Well, Quakers were behind all three big chocolate companies, which were Cadbury's, Fry's and Roundtree.
Yeah, so weird.
And because at the time, Quakers weren't allowed in the professions. You can be a doctor or anything like that. Oh. And they weren't allowed in public office. So they were in trouble.
Well, if you can't
basically
do those two, you've got to go into sweets and confectionery. But also, I suppose if they're not drinking, they've not got a lot of good stuff going on. So, like, let's absolutely cane it on the chocolate.
Yeah.
That's
yeah
the vice.
You're actually missing a fourth Quaker chocolate, and I've got a product of theirs here. This is by a different company now, but I'm holding it in my hand. It's a Wonka bar.
Oh.
And the Wonka bar was created by Quaker Oats. You know Quaker
no
Oats?
Way.
Yeah, they funded the movie. They put $3 million into the funding of the movie, and they had a deal that they would have the chocolate merchandise that would come off the back of it, and that's where we started getting Wonka bars. But they had a huge wow problem because the movie didn't take off to begin with. It was doing fine, but it didn't go massive.
Mm. Really? This is the one with Johnny, with Gene Wilder. Yeah.
And the chocolate itself, they produce at the wrong temperature, as in the melting point of the chocolate was so inaccurate that when it was being transferred it would melt in the trucks right and so on. So they had a few problems and they sold it to different companies, but it was set up by Quaker Oats. So we've got a fourth Quaker company.
Wow.
Did you know that Cadbury's once reverse shoplifted a bunch of their cream eggs?
Oh, so they sort of sneak them into shops.
They snuck them in, yeah. Mm. I couldn't quite work out why they went to these lengths. This was in 2018. You might remember they did a kind of Willy Wonka promo thing where they hid about a thousand white chocolate eggs in cream egg wrapping.
Oh,
and
yeah,
I think if you opened a cream egg, there'd be a golden ticket in there and it'd be a white chocolate egg, and it's really exciting. And then you could win £10,000. But the way they did it was they didn't, when they made the eggs, they didn't tell anyone in the factory in Bourneville that they were making the eggs, and they didn't tell any of the people in the shops where they were planting the eggs. They
so
just
creepy
got this crack team of spies to break into the factory overnight under cover of darkness, go in, make these eggs, smuggle them out, and then kind of in disguise sneak into shops and slip them onto shelves.
How many do we know how many they made?
They said they made about 1,000. Yeah.
That's you can do that job in the course of a night. That's insane.
I think it might have been multiple nights, but also I think a chocolate factory can churn out, yes, even a
they
thousand
make hundreds
eggs
of thousands of cream eggs a year just
I know,
for a tiny
you're
season.
You're
you
breaking
know
in, you got to turn on the lights. You
I'm sure they created a pretext of an away day. We're all going
yeah
on a chocolate listening course, and so no one needs to come to work tomorrow, you know. And if you notice any white smears around the machinery, just disregard it. Get on with your work. So who were the people who were sneaking them
bit
onto the shelves?
Job. That's such a cool job.
I suppose you have to be very high up in Cadbury to get that gig.
But it's also inconspicuous looking.
Very inconspicuous.
Like, you want someone who looks just like a normal person, I guess. I would invent a sleeve that allowed me to drop off an egg.
lay an egg with your arm.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly that. So I would pick up an egg, so no one would notice, and I would go and buy an egg, you know.
Yeah.
But
sure,
no one's noticed the one I've secretly laid in the egg tray.
Right.
Can I tell you like a real life Willy Wonka?
Mm.
Yeah.
This is a guy, have you heard of Forrest Mars?
No. Was he responsible for Mars Bars?
He was.
Wow.
Forrest Mars.
Forrest Mars. Also Maltesers. Invented those. Mm.
Okay.
Also Pedigree Chum and Uncle Ben's Rice. But those were like
wow
his
sort huge
of,
though
like solo albums of his uh-huh his main career was in the confectionery world.
Did he hands on invented all of those?
I don't know.
Invented rice?
I don't. There was a technique with Uncle Ben's rice. It was just, I can't remember.
In a pouch.
I don't know how on his hands were on Pedigree Chum, like, but he's a big deal. He's
yeah,
a huge
yeah
deal.
Big
yeah
guy, big guy.
And he did. I think he did with Maltesers. He took this tiny pellet of dough, this pea-sized pellet of dough, and then put it in a vacuum oven. You know, exploded it in a vacuum, and then you cover that in chocolate, which is how they're made today. They're made in a vacuum. Anyway, very cool. But Forrest Mars was very eccentric, as in he was a bit of a tyrant. He would get his executives on their knees praying in meetings. He would lead them in prayers saying, I pray for Milky Way. I pray for Snickers.
For the success of it, or like literally for a bar of
for the success of it. So, and he was a tyrant, I think, domestically as well. His adult son John once asked to miss a sales meeting, so Forrest Senior said he had to spend the entire meeting on his knees in prayer. So I think, and
he's very into making people just get on their knees and pray.
A lot of
it
praying as a theme.
Yeah.
A lot of praying going on. He was so secretive about his life that when he died in 1999, Mars wouldn't even confirm that he died.
Gosh.
I know. Wow. So there is a bit of, like, it's a quite an odd biography. Someone once saw him in an airport and shouted out, Forrest, Forrest Mars. And he marched over and he
said, made them get on their knees and pray.
That's right. It's more conspicuous, actually. He marched over and he said, don't ever call my name out in public. She was so concerned about being recognised or spotted or any of that.
Yeah.
I mean, really an unusual guy.
Why have you called your biggest product after yourself?
What, Uncle Ben?
Okay, it's time for fact number three, and that is Anna.
My fact this week is that the thumbs up emoji is contractually binding in Canada. So be careful, Canadians. And this was as of this year. No, as of last year, 2023. We're now in 2024. But this is because of a legal case in Canada, in Saskatchewan. And they have the system there where a legal case will set legal precedent. You know, that will be the one that they refer back to. And there was a legal case where a guy called Kent Mickleborough, a grain buyer, who wanted to buy some grain. So he texted a bunch of farmers and said, anyone got any flax to sell me? 86 tons of flax I want at...
86? Why 86, Kent? Is it called Kent Mickleborough?
Kent Mickleborough, that's
pretty
right.
Pretty cool name. Frankly, wasted on a flax buyer.
Careful,
no
buddy.
Offense.
This guy's litigious.
Flax buying is the coolest career.
Yeah, sorry, yeah, yeah. So he needs the 86th ton for whatever reason.
He wants 86 tons, exactly, at precisely $17 a bushel. And one farmer responded, Chris Achter. That's A-C-H-T-E-R. Chris Achter responded. They chatted on the phone. And Kent was like, cool, I'll text you a contract. Kent texts him the contract saying, please confirm this is the grain you want to buy, you want to sell at this price. And the farmer responded with a thumbs up emoji. Mm-mm. Fast forward a few months, grain doesn't arrive. Kent's like, where the hell's my grain, mate? You agreed to this contract. Farmer says, no, I was just saying I've received the message. I wasn't agreeing to the contract.
It's confirming that he's thumbs upping that this is the contract.
That I am that man.
Yeah.
Yes, that's me.
But he's not signing...
No.
I understand that. Like, I get that position. Like, I've received this contract. Thank you. But I then never signed it.
Well, so these were the two positions that went to court.
Yeah. I think I'm on Chris Achter's side.
Well, let's argue it out, as they did in the Canadian courts. Your side lost, I'm afraid.
Oh.
And he had to pay $82,000 in damages. Because it was determined that thumbs up, because the guy said in his text message, you said, please confirm this is okay. Mm. And then with a picture of the contract. And I'm with you. A thumbs up can just be like, I'm really late. I can't be asked to respond now, but I'll do something to put them off.
I think it's an incredibly... I don't want to weigh in with like an opinion here, but I think it is quite a passive-aggressive thing to do a thumbs-up emoji. I tried. I sent you one earlier this week, Dan, as an experiment to see how it felt.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't feel great after sending it.
Oh.
You know.
Really? What, you felt like it's a bit of a thumbs-down?
I feel like it's a bit of a, yeah, whatever, mate, like, jog on. You know, it's sort of a...
Well, it was a weird response to me telling you my dog died.
Jog on, mate. Instead of a thumbs-up, I've started doing a top hat.
Sort of a
jaunty, just like a cool, I've got my glad rags on. I think is what I'm saying there.
No, I like that. I would feel a bit special receiving a top hat from Stevie.
Yes, that's what
Stevie,
I like to do. But also, as when my driving instructor, I have to formally confirm contractually over text, and he'll say like this time in this place, confirm, and I just put a Y, and that is like if I.
Why are you asking me to confirm?
And a top hat, and he doesn't seem to think that. No, why for yes.
Right,
and
okay.
When I do that, I am in this obligation to not cancel within 7 days, and I did have to because I got COVID, and I was liable for like £250, and like so. It, but also, isn't it because like if you. What's the word?
This has turned into more of a personal complaint about your driving instructor cancellation practice.
Because I read about a while back, a long time ago, but maybe in 2019, about how like emojis are used in court for like someone sent their partner or ex-partner a gun emoji and actually got sentenced for threatening, because people do use them in terms of words. So if you're gonna, you've got to, I suppose, come down on one side of it. You can't just go, well, if it's a threat, yes, but if it's a thumbs up because of flax, no. I suppose it's quite tricky.
You can see. I'm just excited that you have first-hand recent experience of this actual fact.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You've set legal precedent, you and your driving instructor. instructor.
Top hat means yes. 250 quid, please. Oh god, yeah.
It is an interesting point though, like what if he had sent a heart, for example, in response, you know, what would be, where's the boundary of legally binding?
And you.
Yes, you're right. I think because thumbs up has that meaning. Yeah. I can sort of understand why it went that way as well. You know, like it's a yes, isn't
Sounds
it?
Good.
And in fact, that was a thing that was brought up in court because the defence raised concerns that what if you send a fist bump? Is that a contract?
Or is that I'm going to punch you and that's threat and then you get sent to prison?
Exactly. Yeah.
Or that lady tango dancer in the red dress. Yeah. I would take that as an absolute yes. Like, we're going.
You're sending twice as much flax as they've asked
for. We're dating now.
Dating the flat.
Yeah. No, but I think the judge said, don't be silly. This is about a thumbs up. And that's all it is, you know.
Just to Andy's point about the thumbs up, actually, in China, you'd be right. Apparently, the thumbs up emoji in China is bad amongst the youth because it is but they asked some Chinese people
what, like passive aggressive
basically. Gen Z's in China said that if someone sent them a thumbs up it means I don't like talking to you, I want you to go away.
It reads like okay and no punctuation. That's what it reads like. Are you angry?
If I ever send okay and a full stop, that's as angry as I can possibly express myself. Like that's absolutely white hot with fury, you know. You know the Gargas cave paintings in the Pyrenees? The
intimately.
Ancient... Yeah, yeah. Those...
Who doesn't?
No, can you explain? I don't know.
Sorry, yeah. But there are these cave paintings in the Pyrenees, in the Gargas caves, and they're very, very, very old. They're between 20 and 40,000 years old. They're quite hard to date, but like they're old. Mm. And they're all stencils of hands, right?
Okay, yes.
And there are amazing images. They're beautiful. If you look them up, they're sort of dozens of hands overlaid on each other.
I have seen this,
I think they made them by putting the hand on the cave wall and then spitting ochre paint.
Really?
Gross. But the weird thing is, about half the hands appear to be injured or mutilated. You know, they're short a finger or two, or some of them are short all four fingers. Mm. And there's a theory that it's a language about hunting, or it's an indication of something or another. But there is a theory that could be the first thumbs up. It's either someone who's been tragically, ritually mutilated with the loss of all four of their fingers, or it's the first ever thumbs up. It's an emoji. Yeah.
That's fun.
So it's hard to know.
Yeah. Are Egyptian hieroglyphs like emojis?
They are, because they're open to interpretation.
Yeah.
And they're pictures.
Great, thank you.
Yep. Yeah.
Goodbye.
Do you think they actually had a writing system, but it just got so popular with the emoji side of things? Because that's where we're heading, anyway.
They were really frowned upon at first, the hieroglyphs, among the older generation.
Hieroglyphs are passé.
Dumbing it down.
Right, where does the word emoji come from? What does it mean?
Oh.
Emotion and something Japanese.
Bang, you fell right into my trap. Oh. It's nothing to do with emotion.
Oh, wow.
I find this so weird. So it's from the Japanese words for picture and character. So air is picture, moji is character, right?
That's weird.
It has nothing to do with emotion. But weirdly, do you remember the emoticon?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like a colon and then a closed bracket is a smiley face.
Yeah.
That is an emotion icon. And that came first.
That's
but then
so
emoji
weird.
Came second and is nothing to do with emotion.
This is like the sun and the moon being the same size coincidence. Mm. This is all falling into place.
Yeah. I suppose it's like a lot of emojis that have got nothing to do with emotion, like a suitcase or like the Easter Island head.
Exactly, yeah.
So that does now kind of check out, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I like what they decide to add each year. So like there was a big uproar because there was no avocado for ages.
Right.
And I think there wasn't a seal for a long time and that really got me down. And I think they've added
a seal like when you seal an envelope.
No, a little sea line.
Right, okay.
Again, Anna, we're getting of a glimpse into your communication style.
And mine.
Well, wax seal. There was no wax seal.
I send it by seal. That's what I do.
Do you know what the least popular emojis are? Because I really looked this up because when you go to send one and you see this vast selection and you think, God, none of these must ever get a look in, ever. Mm. And there's actually a Twitter account called @leastusedemoji, which kind of sadly for it doesn't seem to have tweeted since 2020. But in 2020, the same one had been top of its list for 264 days, which I guess is when it gave up and thought this is the ultimate loser. Any guesses?
What am I doing with my life?
Even bots get depressed.
Okay, is this gettable?
I don't know. I mean, I guess it's one that you won't have seen very often.
Is it an object?
No.
Is it a flag?
You'll never get it, I've just realised. The least used one is the symbol that is an ampersand, an equal sign, a musical note, and a percentage sign.
What does it mean?
Well, I suppose no one's ever known, which is why.
Because you don't really get package emojis. Like, that's like four really unpopular ones that have got together in a supergroup to try and bump themselves up.
Yeah.
It's the opposite of a supergroup, isn't it? Yeah. They thought they would be the Travelling Wilburys, and they, yeah. Also, the tramway symbol, I really thought, Andy, that you can't have been online much in 2020, given that that was the joint least popular. An aerial tramway symbol.
I read something about that, and it was it's a sort of hanging railway. It's a suspended railway.
Yeah.
And I saw someone claiming that there's only one suspended railway in widespread use in the world, and it's in China, which is why the emoji is not used. Actually, there is one in Germany, the Wuppertal-Schwebebahn, which is a very popular suspended railway.
Well, this is great. I can't believe that sounds stupid now.
That's where the train's like underneath the track.
Yeah, it's
right.
So
I've accidentally
cool.
used that emoji before and been like, "Why? What's that?" But that is actually real.
Well,
I didn't know.
Go to Wuppertal, and you'll have a whale of a time. It's a really good. I think they put an elephant in it once. I've just had a memory that.
Oh, it feels
wow.
That unnecessary, doesn't it?
They can't. Can they?
Oh, to prove that it clings to the top, like you can even put an elephant in it.
I think.
to prove that it doesn't fall off. Yeah.
I'm really doubting myself. I've got to find out.
I'm not sure what you do.
Go quiet for a bit and then go. Oh,
did you
Did you put an elephant in it?
They did put an elephant in it.
Right.
They put an elephant in the Wuppertal-Schwebebahn in 1950 as a stunt. Either to promote the monorail or the circus.
Both, I guess.
And
why
it
not?
Fell in. Huh. Panic had broken out in the carriage, which apparently also had passengers in it.
Oh my god.
This is bizarre.
This is insane. I'm just on the Wikipedia for it now. The elephant, who was called Tuffy, was fine and survived another 39 years.
I thought you meant he was fined. I was going to be like, it's not his fault!
Hadn't paid for a ticket, mate.
Right, he was fine. I'm glad he was okay.
She became famous in 1950. Oh, she actually accidentally, obviously, fell from the Wuppertal-Schwebebahn into the River Wupper.
Oh no, okay. But she survived.
Yep.
For 39 years.
Yeah.
Got to keep that in mind.
How did she fall? Did they not shut the doors?
Well, what it says here is that... She was put on the monorail as a publicity stunt.
Yeah.
Tick. Elephant trumpeted wildly and ran through the carriage, broke through a window, and fell 12 metres down into the river, suffering only minor injuries. A panic had broken out in the carriage, naturally, and some passengers were injured.
That's right. A big-ass window.
Yeah.
It's a big elephant, window, though. Yeah.
Or small elephant.
Small elephant. Asian elephant, not African
Depends
elephant.
Depends how you're looking at it. Are you through your legs, or are you... Okay, it is time for our final fact of the show, and that is Andy.
My fact is that there is a fish that spends its entire life upside down.
Is it trying to make the moon look smaller?
That's right. This is a fact. It was sent in, actually, by Kate Blazinski. So thank you, Kate. It's about a kind of anglerfish.
Sorry, that does sound like a pseudonym for Anna.
Kate Blazinski. Yeah. You're absolutely right. This was sent in by Anna. So anglerfish are the ones which they have a tentacle and they have like a fishing rod sticking out of their head and then they use the end of the rod that's got a little glowing ball of light on it and they use that to attract prey to them.
It's pretty incredible. We say it casually.
It's amazing.
But you've got a light bulb hanging off your face.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
it's absolutely amazing.
Well, and it's bacteria that is lighting it up as well. It's not like an actual light bulb. It is an actual... You've got to feed the rod for
it's
them to...
so weird.
Yeah.
Like, it's genuinely amazing. And sometimes they accidentally chew their own tentacle rod thing. Because they close their mouth and they go, you know, and then they... Obviously, sometimes they trap themselves. Ow! Anyway.
Like biting your tongue, basically.
It's basically biting your tongue. Yeah. So this is the whipnose anglerfish. And for years, it was just assumed that it went the right way up. It just went around the right way up. Yeah. People assumed that.
Because we've only seen dead ones, presumably, with anglerfish, right? You don't often see them in the
Because they live
wild.
Very, very deep in the deep ocean. And it was assumed to be upright, an upright fish, like all fish. But... they got some camera footage in 1999 of one of these swimming around the ocean upside down with the fishing rod dangling down beneath it. Very weird. They thought, what a weird one-off fish. And so, but they keep finding these, like, deep sea drones keep filming these anglerfish swimming around upside down, and it appears they spend their whole life swimming upside down to attract prey.
But who apparently knows? It is better for it so that it doesn't bite itself. That's in part of the description of the whip nose. Yeah, it's just helpful. It just gives it a tiny bit more of it of an advantage.
It's quite cute.
They're very cool. Anyway, they're so weird.
Anglerfish are insane. They do this thing, and I know I always like get too surprised by this, but evolution. Whoa. What a great idea! Like, one of the things is that it's got, like, it's bioluminescent in that rod, but also it will eat a lot of fish that are bioluminescent. And an anglerfish has a really elastic kind of tummy, very rubbery, so it can eat things that are almost twice its size, right? And so it goes quite transparent, except it doesn't, because there's black lining on the inside, so you can't see the bioluminescence inside it.
Brilliant.
So it can't attract predators, you know, if there's something inside swimming around that's still not dead. Kind of like a car that has tinted windows. You don't know what's inside the car, but you can,
It does it on purpose so that it's not gone transparent. I went to the gym once and my leggings had gone see-through and everyone could see my knickers and butt.
Right.
That's the opposite. Yes.
So if you'd had this ability.
If I was an anglerfish, I could have just made my leggings more opaque, for example.
One of the many reasons to want to be one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That really puts it in context.
It does. Thank you. It's wanted to really bring it down to earth or up to earth.
They are, this one that you mentioned, Andy, the whip nose, is a classic anglerfish in that it's just the females you're talking about. Right?
Yeah.
Okay. It's pretty much whenever anyone talks about cool stuff with anglerfish, it's just the ladies, because they are way bigger than the males. So in the whipnose ones, then the females are like 1.5 meter and the males are 2 centimeters. Yeah. And I think there's another kind of anglerfish which has the Guinness record for the biggest dimorphism between males and females. And this I find so hard to believe, but Guinness says that the females are more than 60 times the length of the males and 500,000 times as heavy.
That's crazy.
Which mating must be wild.
Mating is odd.
I think mating is basically the male sort of latches onto the female, kind of bites the side of her, and then fuses and then dissolves into her, and all that's left is a tiny pair of testicles hanging off the side.
I can't. That's incredible.
That's basically it. Their skin and their organs all fuse together.
And for a long time, I think they assumed that there wasn't a male in the picture at all, right? They just thought it was a female.
And actually, you're looking. That's him.
That's him.
I know those testicles anyway.
This is great.
Yeah. We all know couples like that.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I wonder if there's what the perfect distance is, kind of like with the eclipse of a moon and the sun, that you could have the male anglerfish near you and the female that they will appear to be the same size.
Yeah.
Do you get females, don't you, which have lots of pairs of testicles just hanging off them?
Yeah, you get you get six or seven males will have been fused into one female at once.
Really?
Yeah. You have multiple.
It's just like, you know, have you had many previous boyfriends? No, actually don't. You don't need to tell me.
Or it's like a brownie sash with your badges that you've collected.
Yeah, exactly.
That's how you explain this to your 5-year-old. Yeah. It's like brownies.
Oh, no, they're brilliant. They're so good.
They are. And they do, when they're larva, they look really cool. And there's not enough focus on this in the anglerfish world of chat. When they're larva, they're surrounded by this jelly egg. So that is transparent. And so you'll see this tiny little anglerfish. And then it's got this big see-through pile of jelly around it.
Like zorbing.
Like zorbing, exactly.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. That's very
zorbing.
Cool.
Have you guys ever seen an anglerfish?
No.
In person?
Not in the flesh.
No. I've met one.
Get what? Away.
Yeah, I met one. I met a very famous one. I met the one that basically was in Blue Planet that was discovered by...
celebrity anecdotes are so exhausting. Are you a close personal friend of this anglerfish?
I was at a cocktail party with her. We got chatting. We're working on a
podcast. She doesn't even remember you, Dan, okay?
How many testicles did she have on?
No, years ago, I got to work with Alistair Fothergill. He came on Museum of Curiosity, and he's the person who found the hairy anglerfish. So he went down, he filmed it. They
it's a euphemism and a half, isn't it? Did he show you his hairy anglerfish? Blimey.
So they brought it back up and it dies in the process. So
when they died, did their lights go out? Like a Pixar.
They might do. But they would live on, wouldn't they?
They would, that's even sadder.
Because this is the nuts thing, is that the bacteria.
Yeah.
And I was reading a thing, how do they get these bacteria?
Yeah.
Because normally when hosts have symbionts, you know, things living on them that rely on them, they either find them in the local area or they inherit them from
the parents. Hot, sexy symbionts in your area.
The bacteria want to live on your nose. But they sometimes inherit them from their parents with other animals. But anglerfish never have any contact with their parents. It would be insane for them to...
Dad's been dissolved. Come say hi to your father.
He's like,
give him a little jiggle.
There's a real male role model problem, isn't there?
But they don't get their lure until much later in life even. So they must find them in their area. They must pick them up from around the place and they have them on the end of their nose.
What if they didn't find enough? That would be like a Pixar film, like the anglerfish that couldn't find the bacteria.
That's a good one.
That's good.
Maybe edit that out so I can write it. Yeah. No, I'm joking. Please don't. I will never write that.
Yeah.
I found something that swims, but it can never be upside down.
Ooh.
Mm. Riddle me this. What could that be?
Something big and
my
flat.
My vision.
Like a manta ray? Maybe they're big and flat, but they can't. Mm. They swim, but they... No, okay.
No.
Okay. Right. A starfish.
Not a starfish.
Oh, stupid.
A ball.
You've got to think more
laterally. A ball. A ball has no upside down.
A boat.
Do they swim?
A water boatman. I was actually just...
Shall I just give you the answer?
Yes.
Yeah. Probably, yeah.
The answer is the word swims.
Snooze.
Swims is an ambigram. You flip it upside down and it's exactly the same.
I've got very hot.
Wow. With arousal?
Yes, I'm incredibly aroused. That's
amazing.
I love that stuff.
That's a really good... That works perfectly.
Great.
That's great.
Mm.
That's really nice. Lovely stuff,
that's a good
Dan.
Riddle.
Who would have thought?
The riddle.
Years in.
Finally.
You can stay. You've passed the audition.
I said a boat. What's wrong with me? That's why I host this podcast.
They don't swim and they can be upside down.
Famously.
Just another thing on how fish swim.
Yeah.
Do you know how to tell if a fish is depressed?
Oh, no, don't.
Ooh.
Is too sad?
Okay.
Because we've got a cure.
Great.
There you go.
What a roller coaster.
I know.
So you haven't said the fact yet, please.
That's the cure. Come on the podcast. We'll raise your spirits right up.
What's the cure?
Well, antidepressants. And we only have a cure because we've trialed human antidepressants on them to make them better.
How do you know that they're depressed?
So they swim at the bottom of their tanks. So depressed fish swim low and happy fish swim at the top of the surface of the water or at the top of their tanks. And this is actually really useful, according to scientists who do trial antidepressants, because it's a really obvious sign that they're depressed. So we can trial antidepressants on them and we know if they're working. And
they just go higher.
Because they just get higher and higher. So you go, oh, Prozac, that's doing the trick. Look, it's like in
it's
the
out
air.
Out the water, yeah. is it true, or have I just like made this up in my brain that like goldfish like grow to fill their tanks? So if you actually give them a bigger tank, they just keep going.
That is true.
And that's so sad in retrospect, because you know, like when I was growing up, we had just like a little tank with three fish, and you're like, God, we were sort of shrinking off
their potential.
Yeah.
But that's the thing, when people throw them into the wild, into little lakes and so on, they just turn into these turbo shark. Yeah.
Exactly. You were doing a public service by keeping them from, you know, taking over. Upside downness?
Sure.
This is a very weird thing. Which is better for a rhino to be? Upside down or not upside down, lying down?
Is it in the circus?
It's not in the circus. It's not...
Okay.
Let me take you to the Wuppertal Schwebebahn. No, okay. It's better for a rhino to be upside down than it is for it to be lying on its side. Isn't that weird?
How does it get there? Why?
Well, I think we might have mentioned a while ago.
We've done this about the rhinos.
They
transport
rhinos to new areas by putting them in a helicopter, stringing them up by their ankles.
No, not in the helicopter.
Sorry. They hogtie them.
Right.
They lift them up upside down and then they fly to the new nature reserve where they have to get them to. It's the easiest way to transport them.
Okay.
It takes like 10 or 15 minutes. It's really fast.
Regardless
of where they're going.
And on traffic. Yeah. But they're normally not taking them like from South Africa to Tunisia. You know, it's normally a short journey. But nobody had checked how their hearts and lungs actually cope with this journey. And a team of scientists led by Robin Radcliffe from Cornell realised, we should probably look into whether or not they're
incredibly upset.
Like, and so they held 12 rhinos upside down by their feet for an experiment from a crane. And they're all sedated, obviously, but they were just testing their heart and lungs. And it turns out that it's much better for it to be upside down, because when a rhino's on its side, their lungs are a bit distorted. You know, the gravity means the lungs are not getting equal amounts of oxygen for the air exchange and all of that, gas exchange. But when they're upside down, it is equal because they're just upside down.
Lovely.
So when they sleep, do they go upside down naturally?
They go upside down,
like on their backs.
Like rhinos, if you go for a walk in certain bits of Namibia, you'll look up in the trees and you can see hanging from the trees.
Stop it.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Just want to be on the back. That's all I meant.
No, I don't think
they
lie.
They should.
There are like rhino articles on the web. You've been sleeping all wrong your whole life.
There is another fish that swims upside down. It's not actually a fish, it's krill. Not technically a fish, I suppose. But
forestalling the letters, very nice.
Antarctic krill swim upside down in the Antarctic when the water's covered in ice, so that they can graze like cows on the underside of the ice.
Gorgeous.
And they eat algae that grows on the underside of the ice. And they live such a weird life. They migrate, have quite a weird migration, but up and down. So they graze on algae swimming upside down, and then they get quite fat and heavy from it, and then they sink because they're too heavy, and they have to fan themselves out like a parachute, and they sink about 50 meters down, and then they think, oh God, I'm really hungry again. So then they've used up all their food supply, so then they have to swim up to the top again, eat, and then sink, and that's their lives. And they do it about 3 times a day for their whole lives.
Wow.
Gosh.
And then they die.
But I go to the fridge more than 3 times a day, you know. Yeah. I'm just saying I empathise. That's my life too.
Yeah. Is that your whole life?
Upside down.
Going back
and
forth for a food source, yeah.
It kind of is when you think about
you're
it.
You're so right. Like, it's what we all do, isn't it?
I'm at work, I then go downstairs, I get some food.
But Andy's always got a plate of something that he just comes up with.
Something on the go.
Oh, I thought you, Dan, were saying that is kind of our lives in a philosophical way.
I thought that. The only reason they don't have a podcast is it's too wet for all the equipment. Why?
Something that's no longer upside down. Girls near Richard Branson.
So, please explain that.
He confirmed in 2022 that he would no longer be inverting girls for publicity purposes.
On planes, is it? Or
just
is
all over.
His...
I mean, often near planes.
He
used to do this all the time when he was doing PR photo shoots. He would just be next to a model and then he'd lift her up and, you know.
He'd put her upside down, would he?
Yeah, he wouldn't leave her there. But he would.
Is that so the skirt comes up and you can see the knickers?
I was thinking,
in swimwear.
Here's my theory. You do an upside down handstand with your legs open. You're making a V for Virgin sign, so it's a publicity thing.
And that looks good.
I don't think that's why.
Are you sure this is going to work, Dan? Absolutely, Richard. Nothing can go wrong.
And he said he used to do it like all the time. He was never out of the papers of just turning girls upside down. And he said in 2022, I doubt you'll see me turning girls upside down or picking up ladies today, whereas 38 years ago, if I didn't do that, I wouldn't get in a newspaper. And then he said, I can still turn girls upside down. It's really insisting. I still do it, but times have moved on.
Good on
I love
Richard.
The fact he felt the need to say, I can still do it.
Don't get me wrong.
Anytime I like. The BBC report on this said, Branson's last believed public inversion of a female model was in 2012.
Good year, Olympics, that's
right.
Yeah. Wow, end of the Mayan calendar. That was a biggie. Yeah.
That's what that film was about, wasn't it?
Okay, that's it. That is all of our facts. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in contact with any of us about the things that we have said over the course of this podcast, we can be found on our Twitter, our Instagram, our Threads, our any Facebook. There's so many options that you can find us on. I'm on @Schreiberland. Andy?
@AndrewHunterM. Various.
Stevie?
Mastodon only. No, I'm on Twitter and Instagram @StevieM. The S is a 5. I regret it.
Right. And if you want to get to us as a group, Anna, where do they go?
You can tweet at no such thing or email podcast@qi.com.
Yep, or you can go to our group account, which is at no such thing. All of our previous episodes are up there, so do check them out. Also, lots of bits of merch, and also there's the Club Fish entrance point. Join us, get access to all those fun things like drop us a line, all the extra bonus shows that we do. That's all there. Anyway, otherwise, just come back next week. We'll be back with another episode, and we'll see you then. Goodbye.